From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The Chechen War is virtually over, the capital of Grozny is destroyed, and the on-again, off-again peace talks are scheduled to resume on Saturday. On today's Fresh Air, what is the war about? We talk with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist David Remnick, who just reported from Chechnya for The New Yorker. He'll tell us about events leading up to the Russian invasion and why no Russian military official wanted to lead it. Then we'll talk with Craig Cuny, who has been in Chechnya searching for his missing father, Fred Cuny, a relief worker who disappeared in April while doing a medical evaluation of Chechnya. That and more coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. For many Americans, the war in Chechnya is just one more ethnic conflict too confusing to pay much attention to. My guest David Remnick wrote an article in last week's New Yorker that puts the conflict into focus. Remnick was in Chechnya in May. He's the author of the Pulitzer Prize-winning book about Russia, Lenin's Tomb. About 30,000 people have died in the Chechen War. There's a shaky ceasefire in effect. Peace talks are scheduled to resume on Saturday. The Chechen Republic decided to break away from Russia in 1991 after the dissolution of the Soviet Union. Determined to crush the rebels, Russian troops invaded last December and turned the capital of Grozny into what Remnick describes as a slaughterhouse. He says the destruction of the city was appalling and utterly senseless. I asked him to describe what Grozny looks like now.
The way it looked to me was no different than the pictures I've seen of, say, downtown Dresden or Stalingrad or Berlin after the war. It is utterly and completely destroyed in the central part of the city. It's a shocking sight.
How many people are left in the city?
Well, there was some warning that there would be a war, of course, and tens of thousands of people left the city. It was a city with a population of 400,000. I think there's about 100,000 people in the city now, maybe more at this point. Some people are coming back. The bombing is long over. There's still sniper fire, still some skirmishes, but the bulk of the war, the heaviest part of the war, of course, is finished.
You compare in the article you wrote for The New Yorker the amount of shelling in Sarajevo and in Grozny, and you say at the height of the shelling in Sarajevo, there were 3,500 detonations a day. In Grozny in the winter, at the peak of the war, there were 4,000 an hour.
Yeah, I gave that statistic not in any way to denigrate or to poo-poo the calamity of Sarajevo and Bosnia, which is the real shame of our time, or at least the shame of our American-European time. But I did want to give some sense just how intense the bombing was in the winter, just how brutal the attack directed from the Kremlin on its own city, after all, really was. This again, Sarajevo, large parts of it stand, or there's many damaged parts. There's many buildings with lots of damage. Many, many people have been killed. But the intensity of the war in a short period of time in which 30,000 people were killed, mainly in those 2 months, January, February, is just astonishing. And I should say that the way of the world and the way our memories work and the way our focus on news works is that it's the habit of Americans and most other people to be able to concentrate on one foreign story at most at a time. And I think most Americans are still having a hard time wrapping their heads around the confusions and complexities of the war in Bosnia. So the war in Chechnya, while well covered in the press, never really penetrated, so far as I can tell, our consciousness in some way.
Well, you write that the destruction of Grozny is appalling, utterly senseless. I think a lot of us are very confused about why it happened in the first place. I'm hoping you can help us understand what this war has been about. What are the official reasons that President Yeltsin gave for the attack on Grozny?
Well, there's a series of reasons. The background is this. In 1991, in August of 1991, of course, there was a coup, an unsuccessful coup against Mikhail Gorbachev. Beginning at that time, and even before, in various regions around the Soviet Union, central authority was falling apart. And that tendency was encouraged, either ignored or encouraged by the Kremlin once it became clear that Gorbachev's power had almost completely diminished and that Yeltsin was de facto in charge. And then, of course, he was, in fact, the undisputed leader of Russia after December 1991. Now, what happened was a Chechen Air Force general named Joker Dudayev returned from his station in Estonia after the collapse of the Soviet Union shortly there, before, and he became a politician who exploited very artfully the twin causes of Islamic nationalism and Chechen independence. Chechen independence being a cause for hundreds of years. You can read about it in the stories of Tolstoy and Lermontov and the poems of Pushkin. You can read about it in the tragic history of the way Stalin oppressed the Chechens in the 40s. But Chechen independence became something radically different from some of the other independence movements around the country and around Russia. It also became a center of organized crime. It no longer paid any taxes into the central budget. Dudayev was an uncommonly criminal leader, although certainly we shouldn't overlook the fact that Moscow itself is riddled with organized crime. That is the background of it. We shouldn't think that in Chechnya in any way resembled the sort of sweet save the whales atmosphere of the Baltics in the late 80s.
Yeltsin called Chechnya an outlaw state, a criminal state. How much of a center for organized crime has Chechnya become, and how much of a reason do you think that really is for the attack on Chechnya?
Well, I'd call it a pretext rather than a reason. I mean, you wouldn't sanction the United States Army bombing Brooklyn and Queens in order to get rid of the Gambino family. It's rather insane. But on the other hand, you don't want to deny the criminality of the mafia itself. The mafia itself in Chechnya went all through the government, and it really became what one of Yeltsin's aides called, legitimately, a free economic slash criminal zone. It was the one area or one of the few areas in Russia where flights could come in from abroad carrying all sorts of contraband in which customs officials were completely bribed and allowed it to go on. It was an area of the country in which the so-called Vazdushniki, the air people, so-called because they seem to have gotten their money from the thin air, made billions of dollars through bank frauds in conjunction with corrupt officials in Moscow. There were all kinds of criminal scams involving the vast oil supplies and oil refinement industry in Grozny. A lot of people were getting very rich, so much so that when you go around in Chechnya, you'll be shocked to find, especially if you have, like me, lived in the Soviet Union or former Soviet Union for 4 years, see houses that look like a kind of further vulgarization of the houses in Beverly Hills. I mean, these kind of very ornate and fantastic huge houses. I mean, you'd never see this in most other parts of the country.
But you say that the connection of Chechnya to organized crime was just a pretext for Yeltsin. What do you think the real reasons were for the war?
Politics and power. I think that certainly there was a terrible situation evolving in Chechnya that had been evolving that way since 1991. It had been all but ignored by the Central Russian government because, after all, the Central Russian government had its attention focused on other things, quite legitimately, economic reform, political reform, the battle with the White House, the 1993 uprising, I mean, various political crises that kind of make our political crises look tiny by comparison. So it evolved and it was ignored, and Chechnya was recalcitrant, and Yeltsin refused to negotiate with Dudayev and vice versa, and it just reached a critical point. And the critical point came at a time when Yeltsin's own abilities had deteriorated for reasons of health or drinking or what have you, and he was surrounded by the most reactionary ministers, sounds familiar from 1991, a la Gorbachev, and they pushed Yeltsin toward war, the brink of war, and Yeltsin acquiesced. He did it, and he bears the terrible responsibility of a war on his own people.
Did the people who were encouraging Yeltsin think that this would establish the power of Yeltsin's administration and the new Russian state?
Well, precisely. They thought it would be quick and easy. They didn't think it would be a 30,000 people dead. They thought it could be accomplished, in the famous words of the defense minister, in 2 hours by one paratroop regiment. And they also thought that it would be very popular on the populist level, because Chechens are extremely unpopular among Russians. And the reason is that Chechens, for one reason or another, have the image as a mafia people. And when you hear people complaining in Moscow about the mafia, very often the reference will be to those Chechens. Well, of course, it's not true. All ethnic groups are involved in the mafia in one way or another throughout Russia. But this is the ethnic group that's despised above all, more than Jews, more than Azerbaijanis, more than anyone else.
The Chechnya is primarily a Muslim state. How much do you think that figured into the calculations of Yeltsin?
Well, I think that was a factor that was exploited by Yeltsin. We kept hearing about mercenary fighters coming in from Turkey or Afghanistan, and this, for the most part, was rubbish. I don't think it was a major factor. It was a means to isolate Chechnya, I think. But you should remember that that Dudayev was exploiting this kind of Islamic nationalism in his own land, and he himself knew next to nothing about his own religion. When he was interviewed by someone from the Los Angeles Times, he said very self-confidently, "You know, Muslims pray 3 times a day." And the reporter from the LA Times said, "You know, I think it's 5 times a day." And Dudayev said, "Well, the more the merrier."
If you're just joining us, my guest is David Remnick, and he's a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition of the magazine. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. David Remnick is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. He recently returned from Chechnya. He won a Pulitzer Prize in 1993 for his book Lenin's Tomb. So you say that Yeltsin's aides reassured Yeltsin that winning in Chechnya would be easy. This would be quick, and he'd be out. Well, that was a grave miscalculation. You spoke to some military leaders in Russia. What did you learn was responsible for the miscalculation?
Well, that the miscalculation was political, and the political miscalculation and hastiness led to a disastrously planned military operation. Let me explain, if I can. What happened was the so-called power ministers told Yeltsin the time to act was now, meaning late November and then into early December. He signed a secret decree in late November, and military planning began in high secrecy, unbeknownst to even the top military leadership in many of the services. And nobody seemed to want to lead this operation because they all knew it would be a disaster if it would be carried out so quickly. Remember, December in southern Russia is a time of high fog, terrible mud, and all the rest. Remember how long it took us to plan the American operation in Iraq. It took weeks and weeks and weeks of open planning, transporting of military equipment and troops. This was done all, for the most part, out in the open, and at the same time, military plans and options were being drawn up. You cannot, in the words of the military editor at Sivodnya newspaper, Pavel Felgenhauer, you cannot, as Yeltsin thinks, order up a military operation the way you call up and order a limousine. It cannot be done effectively. But this is precisely what he did. And all of a sudden, the tanks began invading Grozny, and they were being shot by what amounted to Chechen guerrilla units. And the Russians suffered terrible losses in the beginning of the war, to their astonishment. As the war went along, of course, the superior manpower, the superior equipment of the Russian army prevailed. But this war, although a victory ultimately for the Russian army, cannot be called a success in any way, politically, militarily, socially, or in terms of public opinion.
You talked to a general who resigned over the war in Chechnya, a Russian general, and he said that the planning was so bad that tanks were sent into the city without maps of the city.
Yeah, precisely. You had tank drivers who were told to go into the city. They didn't know where they were going. They were expecting backup that never came. They were expecting air cover that never arrived. And they found themselves trapped, and in many cases, the operation ended in their own destruction and their own death. And this was not an exception. This was the pattern in the beginning of the war.
David Remnick is my guest staff writer for The New Yorker magazine. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition. What are the state of the on-again, off-again peace talks now between Chechnya and Russia?
On-again, off-again.
Right.
They just fumble along, and God knows what will happen there. I'm sure the resolution will be some sort of increased autonomy, but no independence for Chechnya, and probably a fairly considerable continuing military presence in Chechnya.
In your New Yorker article, you wrote, "The rubble in Grozny is a fair representation of what's become of Yeltsin's promise of democratic reform."
Well, I think it may even be a fairer representation of what's become of Boris Yeltsin's political prospects. Someone in the article, one of Yeltsin's more liberal aides, is quoted as saying he doesn't expect Yeltsin to run in the presidential election in 1996. I not only think that's probably true, I also really hope that it's true. I think that Boris Yeltsin has done extraordinary service to his country prior to this. He was an important figure to follow Gorbachev. He went where Gorbachev really could not after Gorbachev's own triumphs. He was a remarkable politician at a time of crisis in 1991, did a lot to shatter the monolith of the Communist Party. And I think he's done a tremendous amount to reform the economy of post-Soviet Russia, despite its difficulties, despite its ups and downs. I think in many ways that's a success story. But in terms of his handling of Chechnya, in terms of his ability to form a kind of stable political democracy in Russia, I think he has hit the wall, and it's time.
Yeltsin's health has not been good.
Mm-hmm.
If Yeltsin was out of commission, or if he died, do you think that there'd be an abrupt policy change on Chechnya?
No. It's over. The Chechen war is over. Grozny is defeated. The villages are defeated. The Chechen army is depleted and is down to just kind of a core of living and faithful. The only policy at this point is the policy of settlement, and there'll be, as I said before, there'll probably be some kind of rough accommodation of a degree of sovereignty and a degree of military occupation. If Yeltsin were to disappear from the scene, his prime minister, Viktor Chernomyrdin, would take over, and I think one of the triumphs of sort of nascent Russian democracy is that I do not think there would be a terrible crisis if he died.
What is the strategic advantage for Russia to hold on to Chechnya?
Lots and lots of oil. You know, it's a landlocked piece of land. It's in the foothills and in the mountains of the Caucasus. This is a traditional area of war for the Russian czars and general secretaries, and now its democratically elected president. There's lots of oil there. And there's also a principle, in big quote marks, the principle being the Russian government, the Russian leadership's political need to set down a marker in terms of self-assertion, in terms of Russian identity. And it's a message to other regions that independence movements of any kind will not be tolerated in their extreme.
David Remnick is my guest, staff writer for The New Yorker. His report from Chechnya was published in last week's edition. I want to switch the focus to Bosnia now. Russia is the only member of the contact group, the allies, including the United States, France, England, Germany. It's the only member of that group that has staunchly opposed the use of military force against the Bosnian Serbs. And I wonder if you see that position as connecting at all to the war in Chechnya. And I guess that connects to another question I'd like to hear your answer to, which is that do you think what Yeltsin has done in Chechnya is at all comparable to what the Bosnian Serbs have been doing?
To the second question, I don't think it's roughly the same. There's brutality involved and so on. But I think the reasons for Russia's behavior vis-a-vis the situation in Bosnia is related to their purposes in Chechnya, and that is that after the fall of the Soviet Union, there appeared this new entity, Russia. What in God's name is Russia? Well, at first, in 1991, 1992, there was talk of dreams of Russia being a kind of European democracy founded upon the principles of Jefferson or what have you, French constitutionalism, what have you. Well, it turns out that wasn't a very popular idea. Not only was Western aid not forthcoming in any large way, Russians became disgusted with the idea of Russia being a country that would just follow in the footsteps of the United States and Europe to form its self-identity. Identity being the operative word here. That's the most important thing. Russia simply just did not want to follow, and it saw itself following in terms of disarmament, following in terms of policy in the Middle East, becoming a very, very junior partner in almost every situation in the world. And there arose, after the December 1993 elections, the appearance of a very strong, very vocal, pro-nationalist wing of Russian politics, embodied by, in an almost comic and scary way, by Vladimir Zhirinovsky. It became absolutely untenable for the Russian politicians to simply be seen as following all the time. And so on. In the situation of Bosnia, they can feel that they cannot be seen to sanction the bombing of the warring against a Slavic brethren, meaning the Serbs. And so I think that's the source of that policy. It's deeply rooted in domestic politics and deeply rooted in the politics of identity.
Well, David Remnick, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
David Remnick's report on Chechnya is published in the July 24th issue of The New Yorker. He's also the author of the book Lenin's Tomb. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations and by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up on Fresh Air, we talk with Craig Cuny about driving around Chechnya in an old Russian ambulance, searching for his father, Fred Cuny, a relief worker who disappeared in April. Fred Cuny was evaluating medical needs in Chechnya. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Craig Cuny has spent the last 3 months driving around Chechnya in a battered Russian ambulance, searching for his father, Fred Cuny, an American relief worker who disappeared there April 7th. Fred Cuny was on a humanitarian mission, conducting a medical assessment of Chechnya for the Open Society Institute. It was hardly the first time Fred Cuny had put himself in harm's way. He's devoted his life to repairing places that have been destroyed by war or natural disaster. One of his greatest accomplishments was restoring water and gas lines in Sarajevo while the city was under fire. After he disappeared in Chechnya, his reputation was further enhanced by a MacArthur Award. Fred Cuny joined us twice on Fresh Air. The last time was about 6 weeks before he disappeared. His 28-year-old son, Craig, is funding his search through the Soros Foundation, which was also funding his father's relief work. Craig has briefly returned home to San Antonio to renew his visa. Earlier today, I asked Craig why he organized his own search, even though the Russian and American governments were already involved in searches.
I've worked with my father in a couple of different operations before, most recently in Bosnia. And I think that I just kind of thought that maybe I'd have an insight to kind of the way he works and maybe some of the things he might have been thinking. To be honest with you, I saw myself as going crazy sitting around here waiting on anybody else to do the things. And I also, just with a little bit of experience working alongside him, I thought that maybe I could introduce some ideas that other people hadn't thought of, and maybe I could get in some areas that other people perhaps weren't able to or willing to go into.
Can you tell us about one of those ideas that you had because you know your father so well?
Well, a lot of times he would go into areas that, you know, most organizations are kind of, you know, dictated by whatever their mandate is for a certain situation. And very often my father could work independent of those sort of guidelines, and he would go into areas that, you know, that would maybe cross different political lines, and also you know, basically because of the makeup of the war, he might have connections on his own that would take him other places. Again, that maybe say a conventional investigator or certainly someone, say, from the, you know, the U.S. government or somebody else couldn't officially go to. And I thought that he might, you know, might have made some, you know, some statements or made some sort of indications to people there who might be more willing to come up to me, you know, in a family capacity than to come up to somebody who's there in an official capacity.
What's a typical day like now on your search?
Well, it's changed faces over the past few months. We went from a whole big, almost three-ring circus, you know, with you know, the Russian, you know, security bureau looking for him, along with various Ingush officials from the neighboring Republic of Ingushetia, you know, some people from his company, Intertech, that's based in Dallas, and also another family member. And you know, eventually, and there was also, you know, embassy involvement from Moscow, and that went hard and fast for about you know, about 6 weeks, and all of those entities are still involved, but essentially, you know, you run out of a commitment that you can leave people in the field that long. So it's kind of gone now to very much a kind of a grassroots approach. It's down to a representative from my father's company, myself, and usually an interpreter, and we usually get up and get into an old Russian ambulance, similar, unfortunately, to the one that Fred went missing in, and just drive into Chechnya, and we try to basically address new areas that we haven't gone to before. And with the sweep that the Russians have made since May, there's a lot of areas that are opening up now, and we're trying to go to these new areas, and we pass out flyers. We talk to people in the market. You know, we go and we try to talk to the women in the villages who usually know a whole lot more, you know, through their own network. And we just have tried to basically put together the pieces of the puzzle one by one and go back and create the trail. We've gone on both sides. We've worked within the part of Chechnya that's now being occupied by the Russians and the Russian military. And we've also, you know, crossed over the lines into Chechnya area, and basically tried to, establish permanent ties on both and channels of communication.
Are there a lot of con artists and opportunists who are telling you that they know where your father is, and what they really want is for you to pay them off?
Yeah, it's unbelievable the extortion attempts we've had. Everything from the really pathetic, forged notes to, basically just, bald-faced lies that, we have him and, you need to give us this to secure his release. And, it's been a real zoo. I mean, we're the biggest show in town, so everybody knows where we are.
My guest is Craig Cuney. He's searching for his father, Fred Cuney, an American relief expert who disappeared in April while on a humanitarian mission in Chechnya. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with Craig Cuney. His father, Fred Cuney, disappeared last April while on a humanitarian mission in Chechnya. Do you have any theories about what could have happened to your father?
I do. We have a couple of theories, a couple that aren't so pleasant and a couple that are. One theory is that he could have... He basically could have been in the wrong place at the wrong time. Around the time he went missing, there was some activity in the area that happened in a couple of villages where there were some pretty intense fights. There were apparently quite a few human rights abuses. That was right around the time that he would have been in some of these areas. If he saw the wrong thing by either side, basically it could have been just a matter of getting rid of somebody who they knew had the influence and the visibility to get the story out and shed a negative light on their cause. On the other hand, one of the better case scenarios is that somebody's feeling a little bit caged, and they again recognize my father's stature in the international community, and they're kind of holding him as their ace in the hole for when this war comes to an end. And maybe it's a passage to Turkey, maybe it's a ransom down the line for whatever they need, or there's any number of scenarios. But we've kind of, just by the process of elimination, we've kind of scaled back the possibility of a direct ransom for ransom's sake, simply because nobody's approached this with a viable offer. The bad case scenarios are that something did happen to him. He was in the wrong place at the wrong time, and my biggest fear, to be honest with you, is that we'll never find out anything. It's the biggest fear is that we won't ever have any closure for this.
I guess that would really be awful. Have you become almost superstitious, since you don't have any hard facts? Are you looking for signs and symbols and feelings that you can work with?
Yeah, I look into the face of every rock and look for a treasure map, and I've listened to every palm reader and psychic, and you know, anybody who wants to smell one of my dad's old smelly socks, you know, I've become incredibly superstitious, and I basically my idea is I'll talk to anybody who thinks that they have an idea on how to solve this whole thing. So,
have most of the soldiers at the military checkpoints heard of your father?
Yeah, actually, they have by now, because at first we were having real trouble getting through, and so we kind of decided to turn things around on them a bit rather than them turn us around. Basically, when they pull us over at the checkpoints, what we do is we jump out at them and come flying at them. My interpreter and myself come out with, you know, flyers, and I start going through this regular spiel, you know, hi, my name's Craig Cuny, I'm here looking for my father, he's a humanitarian, and you know, nowadays we have this big picture of Fred on the front of the ambulance. In fact, we call it the Fredbulance. when they see us coming, you know, they're like, "Oh, geez, here come those kooks." You know, don't whatever you do, don't stop them. You know, they'll get out and talk your ear off for half an hour. You know, so, yeah, we've passed out some cigarettes and made some friends, and as much as anything, now they know it when we're pulling up. They know who we are and what we're there for. So.
A couple of months ago, a body was found that was believed to be your father's body. The face was burned off by sulfuric acid. It turned out not to be your father. What was that experience like when you thought that it might be him?
Boy, I tell you, that was just that was kind of the pinnacle of emotions for us. We were we had just finished meeting a lot of the administration at the summit. And we had that story actually come to us while, literally hours before we were to go in and meet Clinton and Christopher and a couple of the other people, and we were kind of doing all we could to keep a straight face and you know, try to maintain our cool through the meetings, you know, knowing what we knew, and still ask for what we wanted to, in case, you know, this didn't turn out to be Fred, which, you know, luckily it didn't. You know, I think that kind of brought everything to a head, but my Uncle Chris pointed out a good antidote to it all. I think we kind of got our grieving out at that point, you know. I mean, I think at that point we were so sure, and people were telling us, you know, we're 90% sure that's it. You know, I think at that point we kind of, you know, let ourselves, you know, get over it and really address it and, you know, work toward what we needed to, you know, to kind of, you know, work through it. And then we just got very businesslike about it and said, well, you know, let's get some dental records. Let's get to the body. Let's take care of this and wrap it up. And then, you know, of course it turned out to be quite an ordeal, because the body was far inside of Chechen-held area. And it took us another 2 weeks from the first report to finally get in and make a positive, negative identification, if you will. And, yeah, I think that was, again, I think that was a dramatic point in the whole operation.
What do you do in the time that you're not actively searching? Is there any time like that?
Well, you know, you get up in the morning and you take off, and just, you know, it's the little things that drive you crazy in life, of course, but this old ambulance isn't exactly the most mechanically sound thing. So, you know, in your spare time, you're doing stuff like, you know, rebuilding carburetors, and you're going down to the market and pointing at, you know, vegetables, and you know, you're just trying to do the little things that, you know, that make you get by. But I, you know, every now and then you've got to kind of, you know, give yourself some time. And you know, in one of the weirder scenarios, you know, is there's this beautiful river that runs right through the middle of kind of where the front line is right now, and it's the old Aza River. So I've got an interpreter there who's been a big part of keeping my sanity. He's a blues guitarist from Utah. And basically what we do is we go over to the old Aza River and kind of open up the back of the ambulance and pull the stretchers out and put our best Willie Dixon tape on and kind of kick around in the river all day and kind of forget about what in the hell we're there for.
Right. Now that you've been spending months in Chechnya searching for your father, are there things you understand about him and about his work that you never quite did before?
Absolutely. Yeah, I think that the most impressive thing to me, again, has just been the outpouring of sentiment from everywhere, from all over the world. You know, he was so well respected by all sides of this conflict, even that it's just been amazing to me the impact he can have on a scenario, even though he had probably, you know, total time, only been there for maybe six or 8 weeks.
Do you take your cues from him about how to deal with danger?
Probably, and maybe I should get another consultant. But I probably think a little bit too much like him sometimes.
What do you mean, unfortunately?
Well, he's never been one to shy away from something that if there's a direct way of doing something and a way of avoiding the long route, he'll do it. And that's how he's achieved so many things in his life. But who knows? Maybe that's what got him in trouble this time. Who knows?
When do you plan on going back to Chechnya to continue the search?
I'm basically waiting on a visa, and I think it probably should come in the next day or two. And I would like to be on a plane this weekend if possible.
Craig Cuny, he spoke to us from San Antonio. His missing father, Fred Cuny, lives in Dallas, where he heads the Intertect Relief and Reconstruction Corporation. This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams is with us. Noah, what's coming up on All Things Considered?
Hi, Terry. In Washington, Whitewater hearings continue looking into the suicide of Vincent Foster. Waco hearings also about the standoff and the attack on the Branch Davidian compound in Texas. Other stories, Don Gagne reports on the planned merger of three big labor unions, the auto workers, the steel workers, and the machinists. Mark Roberts reports on a bounty hunter in Arizona. I'll be talking with John Callahan, an English professor and friend of the late writer Ralph Ellison. Callahan has agreed to put together a book from Ellison's unfinished work. We'll have letters from listeners and the author Reynolds Price about going out on a book tour.
Thanks, Noah. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Jazz critic Kevin Whitehead says over the last 15 years, Montreal has become an important center for new improvised music. One of the mainstays of that scene is guitarist and composer René Lussier. Lussier's latest album, released a few months ago, features 13 players, most of them from Quebec.
Guitarist René Lussier serves up something so unusual, I'm afraid few jazz fans appreciate it when they hear it. Really good fusion music. Fusion is that blend of jazz and rock that was all the rage in the 1970s. Remember the Mahavishnu Orchestra? Critics tended to hate it. Most fusion provided an opportunity for guitarists and keyboard players to get their rocks off and damage your hearing. René Lussier draws inspiration from more thoughtful fusioneers, like Frank Zappa at his jazziest, and maybe some English art rock bands like Hatfield and the North. Lussier's latest CD, Le Cœur de l'Ouvrage, which translates The Heart of the Work, is on the Montreal label Ambiance Magnétique. Of the 13 musicians involved, he's the only one who plays an electric instrument, and he's very good at blending guitar with woodwinds and brass. In Lussier's best writing, jazz, rock, and chamber music are all but inseparable. It's a fusion in the most literal sense. Here's a long excerpt from a typically intricate piece, Cuckoo. Besides the guitar, René Lussier also plays the daxophone, an invention of German guitarist Hans Reichel. Basically, the dax is a heavily amplified plank of wood played with a violin bow. It's both futuristic and primitive. So it's appropriate that Lussier sometimes plays daxophone to sound like a theremin. That futuristic and primitive electronic instrument was a staple of 50s science fiction soundtracks. That juxtaposition of the weird and the lyrical is typical of René Lussier. He's an oddball with a light touch. A fusion musician with a light touch. Now that's someone rare enough to treasure.
Kevin Whitehead writes for Coda, Pulse, and The Village Voice. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerow. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Sherrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton has helped to dedicate the Korean War Memorial. He says the Americans who fought in that war set a standard of courage for all generations. The memorial is placed on the National Mall. It's on the same end as the Vietnam Veterans Memorial near the Lincoln Memorial. More than 54,000 Americans died in Korea, more than 33,000 of them in combat. The rest perished in accidents or from sickness. More than 8,000 Americans were never accounted for. The United Nations plans to increase the number of peacekeepers along the Bosnian-Croatian border. Officials are worried about the Bosnian war spreading to Croatia. Croatian troops are already poised to attack along the ceasefire strip north and west of the Serbian enclave on the border. Croatian troops are fighting Croatian Serbs who have been making incursions into Bihać, Bosnia, which is near the Croatian border. The United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees says the refugee situation in Bihać is dreadful. Spokesman Christianowski says it's been bad for a year.
There's nothing left in UNHCR warehouses. ICRC's stockpiles are also almost exhausted. So as far as the humanitarian organizations are concerned, there's no food in Bihać. I mean, some people might have stockpiled some food, and some people might have been counting on their crop. that 80-something square kilometers of crops are gone now and overrun by the Croatian Serbs. So all that is gone as well.
Bihać is one of the UN's so-called safe havens, which are supposed to be protected. But two of those protected zones, Srebrenica and Zepa, have fallen to Bosnian Serbs who've thrown out the Muslim residents. There are widespread reports of murders, rape, and torture of the civilians. The Allies are threatening the Serbs with airstrikes if they attack another safe haven, Garajda. But it's not clear if they'll offer the same protection to Bihać. Attorney General Janet Reno will explain decisions she made during the Waco standoff when she appears before House lawmakers next week. NPR's Carol Ann Clark-Kelly reports.
Attorney General Reno says the decision to use tanks and tear gas is one she's reviewed over and over, and that she has no problem going over it once again with lawmakers. But she told reporters during her weekly briefing that she still doesn't think she would have done anything differently.
I could have gone in with a frontal assault, which could have been extraordinarily dangerous to all concerned, and we knew that up front. I could have waited. And I won't know and will never know what David Koresh might have done 6 days later or 6 months later or 6 years later.
Reno says since Waco, she has set up a second hostage rescue team for the FBI. Reportedly, one consideration for the timing of the final raid at Waco was that the Bureau's single rescue team was exhausted after a 51-day siege. I'm Carol Ann Clark-Kelly in Washington.
On Wall Street, the Dow is up 25 points. This is NPR. A judge in New York City has rejected a request for a new trial for three men convicted in the World Trade Center bombing. However, he did schedule a hearing to review the competency of the defense attorneys who handled the trial. Dick Hinchliffe of member station WNYC reports from New York.
U.S. District Judge Kevin Duffy dismissed the retrial request, saying purported new evidence was available during the trial and would not have changed the guilty verdict. The men are serving a life term. One of the four men convicted, Ahmad Ajaj, claims witnesses in Jordan can testify that bomb-making manuals found in his luggage belonged to a dead soldier, and Ajaj was returning them to the soldier's family. Lawyers for Mahmoud Abu Halima argued that statements made shortly after being tortured in Egypt should not have been given to the jury. Nidal Ayad claims a voice heard on a tape recording is not his. While rejecting the retrial request yesterday, Judge Duffy set an August 7th hearing for the three men to argue that their trial attorneys were incompetent. The fourth defendant, Mohamed Salama, is appealing his conviction but has not asked for a new trial. For National Public Radio, I'm Dick Hinchliffe in New York.
House Ethics, or rather House Speaker Newt Gingrich, is testifying in private today before the House Ethics Committee about his book deal. Gingrich and the publisher originally agreed on a $4.5 million advance for two books he was writing, but Gingrich instead decided to accept $1 plus standard royalties. Questions were raised about the deal because the publisher, HarperCollins, is part of the media empire of Rupert Murdoch. Rupert Murdoch had an interest in legislation before Congress, and Gingrich had a meeting with Murdoch. Rebel and government negotiators in Mexico's Chiapas state have ended another round of peace talks. The end of the session degenerated into name-calling, but negotiators agreed to meet again September 5th. There have been five rounds of peace talks since April. They've failed to make any progress on the uprising by Indians who are demanding land reform. Both sides are squabbling over conditions for a troop pullout from Chiapas. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington. From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corva Coleman. President Clinton attended the dedication of the Korean War Memorial today. It's been called a forgotten war because it hasn't gotten the kind of attention that Vietnam and the Second World War did. But Mr. Clinton and South Korea's President Kim Il-sung participated in ceremonies honoring Korean War veterans. More than 54,000 Americans died in the Korean War. President Clinton says thousands of them are still unaccounted for. He called on President Kim and other Korean leaders to resolve the cases of those missing in action.
President Kim and I are working together to open the door to better relations between our nations and North Korea. Clarifying these MIA cases is an important step. We have not forgotten our debt to them or to their families, and we will never stop working for the day when they can be brought home.
The new memorial is on the west side of the mall near the Lincoln Memorial. President Clinton has signed a compromise bill cutting spending for this year. It comes 7 weeks after he vetoed the first version of the spending cuts bill. The revised bill restores some money for education and training and other administration priorities. The president says the reworked version shows that he can work with Republicans. The measure would cut more than $16 billion from the current fiscal year's budget. Mr. Clinton says budget cutting is exactly the kind of thing both parties should be doing. The French government has warned the United States that if it unilaterally decides to lift the arms embargo against Bosnia, U.S. ground troops would become involved in the conflict. The U.S. Senate has overwhelmingly voted to lift the arms embargo. Lynn Terry reports from Paris.
French Defense Minister Charles Michel said the vote was a very grave decision. He said if Washington decides unilaterally to lift the embargo and supply the Bosnian Muslims with arms, U.N. peacekeepers in the region would pull out. France, together with Britain, provides the bulk of the U.N. troops. The French government fears lifting the embargo would inflame the war and threaten the lives of peacekeepers even more. So far, 43 French soldiers have died in the conflict. Michel said he would remind Congress that if there is a pullout, President Bill Clinton has promised to send 25,000 American troops to help in the operation. Prime Minister Alain Juppé expressed similar sentiments, saying a lifting of the embargo would directly implicate the United States in the conflict. For National Public Radio, I'm Lynn Terry in Paris.
Orders to factories for durable goods fell 0.1% last month, the fourth drop in 5 months. Analysts say the decline will further fuel an ongoing debate about the health of the economy. On Wall Street, stocks closed higher today. The Dow gained nearly 26 points to end at 4,732. Advancing issues led declines by a margin of 7-4 in active trading of 355 million shares. This is NPR. The Senate Whitewater Committee heard today that a White House aide noticed the torn-up pieces of Vincent Foster's suicide note days before the note was actually identified. NPR's John Greenberg reports.
A private lawyer for the Foster family says he was in Foster's White House office 2 days after the deputy counsel committed suicide. Michael Spafford was talking to the chief White House counsel, Bernard Nussbaum. Spafford says one of Nussbaum's assistants picked up Foster's briefcase. He held it open by the handles and said, according to Spafford, there are scraps of paper in here. Neither Nussbaum nor Spafford attached any significance to the remark. Spafford says Nussbaum replied, "We will get to all of that later." Another 4 days went by before anyone put the pieces of paper together and saw it was Foster's suicide note. Committee Chairman Republican Alphonse D'Amato of New York said the delay is deeply troubling. This is John Greenberg on Capitol Hill.
Union leaders representing steel workers, machinists, and auto workers have agreed to merge. The United Auto Workers, the Steel Workers, and the International Association of Machinists and Aerospace Workers say merging will improve the futures of working Americans. The combination would create a union of 2 million members. Unification is to be complete by the year 2000. The unions plan to gradually meld membership services, legal affairs, communications, and organizing and collective bargaining activities. Forecasters have downgraded the severity of the expected heat wave this weekend in Chicago. Temperatures had been expected to peak above 100 degrees, but a revised prediction says the readings will be in the 90s. Still, officials are trying to avoid a repeat of the disaster earlier this month that caused nearly 500 heat-related deaths. The city is working under a new heat safety plan that targets the frail and the elderly. I'm Korva Coleman in Washington.